Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Justice and Drew, along with Sam. We're going to be speaking. We're going to have Nick Zerwas call in here in just a moment. The house is out of the hill.
He's going to call in around 7:20.
Okay, around 7:20? Okay. Out of the hill, the house failed to pass the right to try bill amid Dems' objections yesterday. Nick was obviously a follower of this, was working on it as well, so we're going to get his thoughts. Locally, the House panel out of the Star Tribune did advance a bill to ban cell phone use while driving. After 4 years of trying, the committee okayed the bill to get the electronics out of drivers' hands. We will get into that a little bit later on this hour before we talk with David Gartenstein-Ross. First off, though, I want to go to the border. Make a run for the border. President Donald Trump was in San Diego yesterday. Said that he needs his proposed border wall with Mexico to be a tough physical obstacle, and those seeking to enter the U.S. illegally are incredible climbers.
I did not know that.
It's out of the hill.
Well, all of them? Well, I mean, is that one of the thing? Like, hey, I'm a good climber. Well, you need to go to the United States.
Getting over the top is easy. They're like professional mountain climbers. They're
little Bran Starks.
They're incredible climbers. They can't climb some of these walls, Trump told reporters during a tour of border wall prototypes. Now, before people get up in arms, if anybody's upset, right, over this. This is out of the hill. We'll give you some more details. We do have an article that we referenced yesterday out of Yahoo that would seem to lend some credibility to what Donald Trump was saying. Okay. They highlighted in Yahoo an individual, Eladio Sanchez, unimpressed by the 8 border wall prototypes looming over his house in Tijuana, Mexico, almost within spitting distance of where Donald Trump was yesterday. At 30, Eladio has already snuck over the border several times, doesn't expect Trump's wall will have much effect on undocumented migrants like him. Pointing to the only prototype with an angular barrier up top and a concrete structure built by a Texas company, he says that one might slow him down a little more than others, but he said you can get over it anyway.
It's just a little more complicated.
So, to what Trump was saying, you know, he wasn't that far off the mark, apparently.
And here's what I don't get. He's got a quote in here. He says, people are always looking for a way to get over out of necessity, not because we want to. If that's the case, then why aren't you just applying to become a legal migrant?
Because that takes time. Because that's complicated. And therein lies the problem, right? I mean, that's if you want to make it easier for individuals to come to the country legally, then you need to go and do what President Donald Trump is doing by trying to bring actual, tangible security to our southern border. The reality is we do already have a wall there. Unfortunately, that wall is kind of a patchwork. It doesn't cover all the areas. In some areas, you can't put a wall at all, and we need better security. We need more Border Patrol agents. And if we do that, right? And this is left and right. You do that, you're going to find a public, a tax-paying voting public that is going to be much more willing to go and look at actual real immigration reform that would make it easier to streamline the process of people being able to come into the country right now.
Yeah.
But that's not going to happen unless you do this border security part first. And again, there's already a wall there. It's just making that existing wall better.
I wish they would, you know, these people, this guy in the story and the people that are referenced in the story that just keep coming over here, you know, and they all talk about, you know, we do this to better our lives. We do this to better our families. They come over here because they can find work and they can make money and they can take it back home. You know, I wish they would focus that energy on making their community and their city better.
Right.
So they wouldn't need to come over here,
right,
to do the work and make the money.
We have laws. It's that simple.
Yeah.
You know, and when people go and argue, not that you did, but I'm saying just in general, when people go and make the argument that most of the people are just coming here to better their lives, you know, because the argument that he lays out here is the presidential campaign calling immigrants criminals and rapists. Look, there is a reality to that. And anybody that's spent any time on the southern border knows that there is a very dark and grim reality of people that come into this country illegally on the migrant trail. There are these things called rape trees. I will won't get into the details of it because it's horrible and awful. I don't want to be talking about it at 7 o'clock in the morning.
The title kind of speaks for itself.
Exactly. Yeah. People pay thousands of dollars to coyotes to have them bring them and their families into the country illegally. If any of them get injured on the way, they leave them behind to die. That's just the reality of it. So when people talk about wanting to come into the country to better their lives, I argue that everybody that comes into the country is trying to better their life. It's how they are trying to better their life that matters. Some people want to get jobs and send money back home. Others are trying to better their lives through criminal activity. Others are trying to better their lives by bringing drugs into the country. So, yeah, we do need better security. I wish Trump would use his words differently. I don't have a problem with what he said yesterday, but on the campaign trail and the wall. And no, we have a wall there. You talk about making what's existing better. That's how this needs to be approached. But this blatant sort of ignoring of we have laws. You know, and to sit there with your house in Tijuana and talk about, I'm just going to climb over it. Can you imagine somebody who broke into your backyard? Well, you can put up a bigger wall, dude, but I'm just going to keep climbing into your backyard.
Yeah, there's this quote here from Sergio Tamayo, the founder of an immigrant advocacy group called Angels Without Borders. He says these migrants that keep coming through, even though there's a fence with barbed wire and everything, he says they are the proof. It's possible to get through. More Mexicans are getting through all the time. And then he says they will always find a way. And he's quoted here, the desert, the mountains, human traffickers. You can't take away that desire to cross to the other side. That desire to build a better life for your family is such a strong, powerful energy. Why did you include human traffickers in there?
Right.
That's exactly who we're trying to keep out.
Yep.
With the wall.
Yep.
With increased border security. And that is compassionate to the victims of those traffickers.
Yep.
That is showing compassion. Making it harder for human traffickers. And these guys got a migrant advocacy group that's apparently helping human traffickers. You're a horrible human being if that's the case.
Well, and we said all along, if you want to be, you know, the left and those that are more on the open border crowd or want to use this against President Donald Trump or the GOP, they talk about how they're the compassionate ones. They're the ones that care about, the lives of these families. No, the most compassionate thing that we as citizens of the United States of America could do is to make the barrier as best as possible to take away the ability for individuals to go and make that decision to put themselves and their families in danger and then go and look at the process at which people can actually come into the country legally. If you've ever been to one of those citizenship swearing-in ceremonies, they are really amazing. I've been to a few of them. And the individuals who waited a long, long time in line to come into the country legally to be a part of the fabric of society, right? They genuinely respect and love this country, and they want to be a part of it. They're not like other individuals who want to break in and simply take advantage of it because they feel like they're entitled to, and they've been encouraged by those on the left that use it strictly to go and push their own agenda. 651-989-5855. All right, Star Tribune. House panel advances bill to ban cell phone use while driving. Advocates jammed a House committee hearing yesterday in support of a measure that would make it illegal to hold a cell phone or other electronic device while driving. They held photos of loved ones killed by distracted driving as legislators debated the measure, which has broad and bipartisan support.
This is going to pass, and it's really not going to change much of anything.
No,
and that's the sad thing is they're focusing their energy on in the wrong direction here to sort of curb distracted driving. This is one of those things that sounds good, sounds reasonable, sounds like common sense. You know, yeah, let's ban people from holding their cell phone while they're driving. Make sure they're using hands-free devices. Okay, that's not going to stop people from doing it. It's just going to make them try to be more secretive about doing it.
Right.
You know, and they're probably going to end up getting distracted more while they're doing it. That's not, you know, I mean, you can reasonably use a phone while you're driving and not be dangerously distracted. It's the looking down at your phone, the texting and the reading of things, not the talking on it.
Right.
That's the problem.
The numbers don't bear it out. There was in the Boston Globe in 2016, they looked comprehensively at this, and they argued that when it comes to the cell phone usage itself, that not texting, but the actual act of having the phone in your hand, right? So arguably, if somebody's talking on the phone, they've got the phone up to their ear while they're driving. It's not the phone being up to your ear that's causing the distraction in that particular circumstance. It is the conversation that you're having that's causing the distraction in that circumstance. So the banning of the cell phone, right, and moving to a hands-free isn't going to solve the problem of the conversation that is going to be distracting you,
right?
And at the same time, to what you were saying, the National Institute on Highway Safety that argued, and you've seen this in multiple cases in places that have enacted this, that texting bans aren't reducing crashes. There's actually a slight uptick in crashes, and our data here locally bears that out. And it's for exactly what you said. People already know that you shouldn't be texting while driving.
Mm-hmm.
You put a ban in place, and what does it do? The worst offenders go, and instead of being more blatant about it and putting their phone up to look at it in text, they're putting it down and they're hiding it, which is causing the uptick in crashes. I don't like more laws. I want to see more education.
Yeah.
And hard education aimed at the youth of today that are going through the driving lessons to show them how dangerous this is.
Yep.
Scare the daylights out of them.
That's the way to do it.
That's what happened with me.
It worked for me.
Red asphalt. You'll never forget it.
Yeah.
Barbara Mandrell on the seatbelt commercial.
And it even, you know, worked for me to in terms of texting while driving. I didn't when I first, you know, got a phone that had texting capabilities, I didn't think much of it. I didn't think it was that distracting. And it wasn't until I started to see the stories and see the results and see the horrible things that had happened to people that had been texting while driving, the horrible accidents that they'd been in, the innocent people that they had killed, you know, because they were texting while driving and not paying attention. That's what got me to stop.
Yeah, right.
It was the educate. It wasn't a law. It wasn't a ban. I stopped texting and driving well before any law was passed.
Yep. The one talking point that really sticks out to me in these studies is when they say that bans like the ones that they're considering, they reduce the cell phone usage, but they're not reducing the crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's key again, because the worst offenders are still going to be the ones that are going to be having the issue.
Will from Chanhassen. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, fellas. I got a couple comments about this texting while driving malarkey that people keep engaging in. I think we need to try to go at the problem a little different way. The cell phone companies themselves can detect when a person is going fast and when they're going slow, because pretty much every phone out there has an accelerometer and a GPS, and it would be something that they could easily determine if they see somebody who's driving down the road or going fast. They could block any text going to that person's phone while that person is traveling at any rate of speed that's significant. Yes, it would suck for the people that are on a bus, but it would be better for everyone else. And I think the way to get the cell phone companies to actually implement this technology is to use the dram shop laws and extend those over to the companies that are facilitating the distraction. We hold bars and restaurants responsible when they overserve a customer and allow that person to get drunk in their facility. And if they go out and have an accident and hurt somebody, the liquor store or the restaurant or the bar, they are responsible for those damages. If you apply that same theory of damages to the cell phone companies that have the towers, they're going to say, wait a minute. We do not want to run the risk of having any texts going to somebody who is traveling at any rate of speed, so we're going to use our software, and we can determine from cell phone to cell phone, tower to tower, when somebody's passing through at a high rate of speed, we're going to block those calls or block those texts from even getting to that phone or coming from that phone, and people are just going to have to wait until they're pulled over.
I get, and thanks for the call, Will. I get the idea of the good intentions, but in the middle of when he was laying that out, all that kept popping into my mind were all the unintended consequences of the overburdensome regulations that you would have to put in place in order to make that happen. My concern on these bills, even in the article itself, Drew, the National Safety Council has said in more than 30 studies that shows hand-free devices are no safer than handheld because the brain remains distracted by a cell phone conversation. The problem that I have with these types of advancement in bills like this is that you end up in a situation where you put lawmakers in a position where, unfortunately, some people see the possibility of revenue generation with this, and they're going to want to see it enforced. And then you're going to have law enforcement that are going out and looking for this type of stuff. And this is a very difficult thing for law enforcement to do. And on top of that, it reminds me of the Southwest light rail argument that we have. What's the technology that's coming? It's driverless cars. It's Uber.
Yeah.
You know, it's these ride-sharing services. We're shifting further and further away from a person even being behind the wheel in charge of their charge of their vehicle.
Yeah, the argument is that, you know, your brain, like you said, your brain remains just as distracted if you're doing a hands-free conversation or a handheld conversation. But that's not the type of distracted driving that's causing the accidents.
Right.
You know, that's the same type of distraction that you have if you're eating a burger that you got at a fast food drive through. That's the same type of distraction if there's a catchy billboard that catches your eye, mm-hmm. and suddenly you're reading that instead. It's the distraction of staring at your phone instead of staring at the road,
yep.
that we need to avoid. That's the texting while driving. That's already illegal. That's already banned. I don't feel like we need more laws in this instance.
We need those seats like you have in NASCAR where they can't put their heads left or right and you just got to stare forward. You just got to look forward the whole time.
Like, change your radio station.
Horse blinders.
That's a distraction.
When was the last time you were driving and you checked out and you drove for like a mile and then you went, oh, and you
like, missed my exit.
How did I get there? Yeah, can we put a ban on that?
See, the U.S. House failed to pass right to try legislation amid Democratic objections. We're going to be joined by a friend of the show, a regular Friday roundtable participant, Nick Zerwas, who probably wouldn't be alive if it weren't for this type of legislation, this type of ability to try experimental procedures for patients. We're going to get his thoughts and dig into what these objections were coming up next. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Welcome back. Hour 2 of your Wednesday edition of Justice and Drew. We will be joined by David Gartenstein Ross in just about 15 minutes. Going to get his thoughts on all the shakeups with the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, being ousted, Mike Pompeo coming in. He knows Mike Pompeo and has worked closely with him at times, so I'm really curious to get his thoughts on how he expects him to perform as Secretary of State. Also, Nick Zerwas should be checking in momentarily on the right to try bill that failed in the House yesterday.
Yeah, and on the David front two, we will we'll get his brief thoughts on these three Illinois men that were charged in the bombing of the Bloomington Mosque. We know who the individuals are, but we don't know motivation yet. They were out of state. It's very very odd situation. So perhaps David can maybe shed a little bit of light on that.
From thehill.com, the House failed to pass right-to-try legislation on experimental drugs yesterday evening after the Democrats expressed safety concerns on how the measure would let patients bypass the Food and Drug Administration. God forbid that a patient ever bypass the much-beloved and vaunted Food and Drug Administration. In a vote of 259 to 140, the bill fell short of the necessary two-thirds support to send it to the Senate. The House had voted for the measure under the suspension of the rules. Joining us now, someone who is very passionate about this issue and about this type of legislation for very personal and justifiable reasons, Representative Nick Zerwas. Good morning.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. Doing good. I'm disappointed. This is something that I'm surprised that there was as much resistance and objection to this as there is. This is a pretty common sense type of thing. If you've got a patient who is likely terminal and who has a condition, and that condition can possibly be treated through some experimental medication or some experimental treatments, and these aren't treatments that are just like pulled off of a back alley somewhere. These are treatments that have undergone some degree of testing, some degree of safety criteria before they're eligible to be used under this right to try legislation. Who do these lawmakers think they are to step in between that relationship between the doctor and the patient?
Well, you're 100% right. What makes this odd is that this has never been a Republican, Democrat issue. Right to try has passed in 38 states. And in every one of those states, Andrew, the dissent was, it was either unanimous, so no members of those state legislators voting against it, or maybe one or two legislators voting against it in a state. And so for Democrats to finally turn this as into a Republican versus Democrat issue, a few months ago, Andrew, this same right to try measure passed by what they call unanimous consent in the United States Senate, meaning that, hey, we're going to pass this bill as long as nobody objects. And not a single United States senator stood to object, and so it passed the U.S. Senate. And so that gave the confidence to the House Republicans in the United States Congress to do a special procedure to pull the bill out of committee with this two-thirds vote to pass it on the floor. And for whatever reason, the Democrats decided that since they were doing that procedure and they could actually flex their muscle and kill something to make a political statement, to turn right to try to help terminally ill patients try for their own personal health care miracle. That is, that is turned that into a political football. I was dismayed as I watched the vote yesterday.
Yeah, a spokesman for the House Minority Leader, Nancy Pelosi, wrote in an email yesterday that the Democratic leader said that they will follow the lead of numerous patient and disease groups in opposing this legislation. It sounds like what you're saying, Nick, is that's just an excuse because they wanted to make this left versus right. I'd be curious to know what the patient and disease groups, who they are, who are opposing this.
It doesn't make any sense. There are dozens and dozens of patients groups and patients that say, why should my Lou Gehrig's disease, why should my ALS, why should my terminal cancer diagnosis be an immediate death sentence when in Europe these drugs are being allowed to be used? It makes no sense. And what the bill says is that if these experimental drugs pass the phase one testing of the Federal Drug Administration, proving that the drug itself will not harm the patient, then the patient should have a right to try. Because, you know what, taking a long shot is a hell of a lot better than going to bed at night knowing you have no shot.
Representative Frank Pallone Jr. out of New Jersey, top Democrat on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, he said that he expressed concerns the bill could harm patient safety by bypassing the FDA. They also said the agency's compassionate use program, saying the FDA approves 99% of requests it receives to let a patient use an experimental drug.
Well, I watched the congressman's remarks yesterday via the webcast, and I'll tell you right now, it's complete and total garbage. the use of compassionate care, truthfully, has improved over the last 30 years as this groundswell of support for right to try has grown. That being said, last year, the FDA approved 1,500 compassionate use cases. I'll tell you right now, sadly, there are a hell of a lot more than 1,500 people that need their own personal miracle.
Yeah.
And if you need that miracle, you shouldn't be saddled with hundreds of pages of paperwork to ask the federal government for permission to try to save your own life. It is fundamentally wrong.
Yep, we're talking life or death situations here. We're talking life or death situations, and these Democrats who objected to this, they want to tell somebody who's facing a life or death decision, life or death possible treatment, they want to tell them, sorry, you got to wait for the FDA. you know, innovation, we talk about it with technology all the time. Innovation happens at a much more rapid pace than government can ever keep up with. There's no field that's more true about than it is in the field of medicine. If there's some innovative treatments out there that, again, have passed some basic safety protocols and they're available, and the doctor and the patient think that that's got a possibility of saving their life, screw the government. Get the government completely out of the way. But these guys know. You got to wait for the FDA to say it's okay. That's ridiculous. I hope they keep trying to pass this.
It makes no sense, Andrew. You're 100% right. The fact that this was turned into a political football at the 11th hour by Nancy Pelosi and Democrats in Congress is just bizarre.
It shows you the extent that they will go to in order to prevent anything that might resemble something that could be that the Republicans could say, hey, look what we passed. This is good. This is compassionate. That's the only reason they oppose this, is they don't want the government. They're willing to let people die in order to continue to further the narrative that Republicans lack compassion. Nick Zerwas, fortunately, we are out of time. We'll look forward. We'll see you this Friday for the roundtable.
Yes, sir. And very briefly, a special thanks to Jason Lewis and Congressman Tom Emmer, both of whom signed on to be co-sponsors of this legislation yesterday and voted in favor of it yesterday. These guys get it. They understand we need to put patients before we put federal regulators.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Nick. Good chatting with you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we have our counterterrorism expert, David Gartenstein-Ross. We're going to get his thoughts on Trump replacing Tillerson with Pompeo. He knows Pompeo personally. Time permitting, we'll get into perhaps his thoughts on the three arrested on the gun charges who are suspected in the Bloomington Mosque bombing. There is a bit of ISIS news, too, so we got a lot to get to with David next on Twin Cities News Talk.
Justice in...
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Justice Andrew, Sam is screening your phone calls at 651-989-5855. You can also use that hashtag TCNT on Twitter. Very pleased to welcome to the show, once again, counterterrorism expert, author of Bin Laden's Legacy, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Find him at defenddemocracy.org. David Gartenstein-Ross. David, how are we doing this morning, sir?
Good morning, Twin Cities. Great to join you.
Let's dive right into it, because we got a lot of stuff that we want to unpack with you this morning. I know you and Drew connected a bit yesterday and wanted to get your thoughts out of the Associated Press and the way they worded it. President Donald Trump unceremoniously dumped Secretary of State Rex Tillerson yesterday by tweet and picked his CIA Director Mike Pompeo to take his place. To that we say, David, go.
First of all, yeah, it was unceremonious, right? He hadn't talked to Tillerson about the fact that he was being removed. I'm a big fan of Mike Pompeo. This is something I told Drew when he reached out to me yesterday. I've known the man for years. I've briefed him on matters relating to national security. He's very intellectually gifted. He's a man of integrity. I thought he would do a good job as a CIA head. Look, everyone has their critics, right? I think in life, one should never trust a person who does not have detractors. So Pompeo has his detractors, but I think that he certainly has performed better in heading CIA than his detractors thought he would. Whether or not his skill set translates into being the country's top diplomat remains to be seen. But I certainly am someone who is a fan of his public service, and I'm proud to say that he's someone who I know. That's the short of it. I mean, I guess the long of it is what we're seeing is Trump trying to unshackle himself. Basically, all the reporting agrees, and this is accurate, that Trump has felt himself hemmed in by certain national security figures, especially, Tillerson, you know, often Mattis, he even feels hemmed in by Kelly, by General Kelly, his chief of staff. And, you know, increasingly he feels that he wants a different team around him, one that he doesn't have to fight with, but instead one who's going to get behind his agenda. He feels that that Pompeo is someone who's more in line with his worldview, more in line with the America First foreign policy that he wants to pursue. And that does relate to this particular change at the top.
Is this a... Do you think this move by President Trump, one, is a... Well, I'm trying to reframe this in sort of a two-part. Is this a good move by Trump? Obviously, you're a fan of Pompeo. But the other part to that is it a good thing that Trump, as you said in your words, is trying to unshackle himself? Is this something that we should be cautiously optimistic about? Or what are your thoughts?
It's a complex question. But I guess the bottom line answer I'd give is no, it concerns me. Generally speaking, in matters of foreign policy, if you look at areas where the U.S. has gotten into the most trouble or made the biggest errors over the course of the past 18 years, it's been us acting too rashly as opposed to being too timid. This is not to advocate for timidity in foreign policy. You know, anyone who's listened to me for the past, you know, however long I've been on your show knows that I'm not timid when it comes to foreign policy matters. But I think two of the biggest errors that we have made since the 9/11 attacks have been the war in Iraq and our intervention in Libya, which really destabilized that region. And that's precisely what Trump himself said when he was campaigning. On a lot of these, if you look at the internal Trump administration debates, it's been, you know, Tillerson and, you know, Mattis and a few others who on most matters have been serving as voices of restraint. So I would just have that in mind paradigmatically, that it tends to be our rashness and not our restraint that has led to major foreign policy errors. Thus, big shakeups. Because we've had a relatively stable foreign policy and national security policy under Trump for the first year plus of the administration. Thus, big changes are, to me, concerning. And so I don't see Trump getting unshackled as necessarily being a good thing, regardless of what one thinks of his presidency. But moreover, when you have someone like Trump in place who has very little, like almost no, you know, basically no prior experience as a public servant, it's relying on the team, which will carry them through. That to some extent, any president is going to rely on his team.
Because yeah, and
you're never
going
to get someone in office who has all the experience you would want. But he came into office boasting of the team, and now as the team is breaking up, that's something which is concerning.
Well, you can look at it as concerning, but you can also, you know, I tend to look at it as, because he had so little experience and because these are not, you know, circles that he necessarily ran in and people that he knew. And when he was a candidate and when he was running for office, a lot of the quote unquote establishment really pushed themselves away from him. So from my perspective, when he was first putting his cabinet together, he probably had a fairly limited pool of candidates that were even willing to come into the administration. And that might have limited who he could have chosen. Now that he's been in there a while and he has some things that he can certainly tout as a success so far in his administration, perhaps, you know, now he's got the opportunity to say, okay, Rex Tillerson, it's like an NFL team, right? Yeah, Rex Tillerson was the best quarterback available in free agency, but he wasn't able to really get the job done. He wasn't really the type of person that I wanted in there. Now that I've got some more resources and a little more experience and a bit of a track record that I can run on, I can say, you know, I can reach out and I can put a person in there that is more in line with my vision for how I want this department to run. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And that could, in fact, be correct. I mean, so in fairness to me, because I don't disagree with your answer, that's what I would like to be the case.
Okay.
The question that was put to me was, you know, the standard question that one asks on, you know, of a pundit or asks on talk radio, which is it good or bad?
Mm-hmm.
And so if I had having to put it into one of those two boxes, I put it in a tempered way into the bad box and the concerned box. But that's
even though you like Mike Pompeo, even though you like the outcome, right?
So it's not. Let me be clear. It's not this move, right? Like, if this is all there is, I'm fine with it. Like, I'm not going to put that in the bad box. I like Pompeo.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily concerned. I don't know as much about the new CIA head. But really what I was responding to is the broader shakeup.
Yeah.
Right? Where Kelly could be gone. And McMaster is almost certainly gone. And there's a number of others who might be gone before too long. So the broader shakeup I put into the concerned category. But again, as Drew said, you know, it could be that he's building, he's starting to find his feet, and he's building a team that he's more fond of, and it will work out well. That's certainly possible, and that's certainly what I want.
Is there any way you can speak to Mike Pompeo and the potential that influence is not necessarily the right word, but what kind of dynamic could he possibly bring? I mean, personality-wise. I mean, you know him. I know that according to the article I have in front of me, he's an ardent foe of the Iran nuclear deal. Right. Was in charge of U.S. diplomacy. The president decides whether to withdraw the U.S. from agreement. We have the North Korea potential meeting coming up. I'm just wondering how big of an influence you think Pompeo could play based on his personality.
He certainly has good chemistry with President Trump, which Tillerson did not. And, you know, you want good chemistry between a president and a chief diplomat. He was a foe of the nuclear deal. I would mark my words. The deal is not going to be rescinded. You almost certainly will hear talk of the deal being rescinded.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it will come from the president. It's not going to happen. And it's actually super interesting, by the way, if you watch Trump's negotiation. This is something which he does well. He negotiates really well. And he talks about this in Art of the Deal, where, he sets an unreasonable anchor and then watches the other side kind of move toward him. And we saw this on DACA. We're going to see it on the Iran deal, and to some extent we already have. What they're certainly going to be pushing for, rather than repeal of the Iran deal, is an Iran deal which is on terms that they consider to be more favorable. And, in addition, they're going to be looking for some sort of acknowledgement of areas where Iran hasn't really upheld its end of the bargain. That's going to be one interesting area. The other area where Pompeo has well-known views is North Korea, where he's a skeptic of negotiations with Korea, you know, as is the case for basically anyone who's been involved in negotiations with North Korea. So that will make a difference as well. And that's obviously one of the key areas of our foreign policy today.
What's your sort of hot take on the? I know that North Korea isn't directly in your wheelhouse. We talked a little bit about it before, but just curious to get your thought on that pending opportunity of the diplomatic opening with North Korea coming up in May.
It's fascinating. I don't think really anybody knows what to make of it. I think that ultimately it's positive. In the sense that I do not want to see us go to war in the Korean Peninsula. I don't think that would be good for America or really good for anybody. At the same time, their continued development of nuclear weapons, their continued development of ballistic missiles is an obvious national security concern for us. It's an obvious national security concern for North Korea's neighbors. So I'm interested to see what will come of it. I think, again, this is an area where I think one of the problems with the administration is that they have not been well coordinated. But if they were well coordinated, Trump's very unique negotiating style is one that I think is one of his biggest strengths as a president.
You may not. We want to throw a couple things at you. Again, talking with David Gartenstein Ross here on Twin Cities News Talk before we let you go this morning. And you may or may not have anything to add, but we wanted to ask you anyways. Locally, three men have been arrested on gun charges that are suspected in the bombing of the Bloomington Mosque. These three individuals live in a suburb in Illinois, a rural community 35 miles north of Champaign-Urbana in Illinois, 47, 22, and 29 in their ages. Apparently, they had there was also charges that they had bombed an abortion clinic elsewhere in the United States. There's no motive attached to this yet based off of what we saw yesterday. These are individuals outside of Minnesota that apparently threw this pipe bomb into the mosque. Do you have any details or any thoughts on this this news that broke yesterday?
Well, based on their target type, I think where everyone's going with this is likely domestic terrorism, and likely coming from political extremist viewpoint. I think that certainly is the first schema that I would apply to it. Obviously, as with all cases, you need more evidence to come out. But I think that's a reasonable first assumption, and that's the first hypothesis I would pursue.
Two more quick things before I let you go on a similar note. How are you keeping an eye on these package bombings going on in Austin? Do you have any thoughts on that? Austin,
yeah,
Texas.
I obviously have been following it, especially with South by Southwest. This is a big concern. It's one of the big concerns we have for all events in the United States. We have a very open society. We've seen package type of bombs used previously with great effect in the Boston Marathon. So independent of, you have both damage they can cause, you have panic that they can cause, and then you have this other ominous possibility, which is that sometimes, failed package bombs going off, those that don't kill or maim anybody or many people, can really be trial runs for something bigger. So all those are things which I'm looking at when I'm following that storyline.
I assume that we kind of know just what we've been told in the media, that there isn't anything, like there's nothing you can share that adds any light on this at this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any other information that's not public. Typically in an investigation, you'll have investigators going through reams of evidence, electronic surveillance cameras and the like. They certainly know things that haven't been made public yet. But also often what is quote unquote known is a whole host of possibilities where they have multiple leads that are being pursued. But it's possible they haven't even honed in on the right set of perpetrators yet.
We need to wrap up, but I'll ask you, maybe we can bring you back on. Should we get you back on soon to talk about some of the news over the course of the past few days about ISIS in Iraq? I've seen a smattering of headlines. I was reading an article out of Newsweek. I know that there's some efforts there for ISIS trying to take back Iraq as allies are switching sides in Syria. Is this something that's worthy of a conversation to bring you back on soon for?
Yes, I would love to. Let's do that.
Okay, great.
All right, David Gartenstein Ross, thank you for your time this morning. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
Coming up, what to expect, all right, in today's hashtag enough national school walkout. We had the Star Tribune story, Drew. Mm-hmm. I made a list of things that are not in the Star Tribune of things you can expect as well.
Also, one of our favorite callers, Don from Burnsville, is on hold. We will get his thoughts.
Don't go anywhere, Don.
His, I'm sure, very cogent and well thought out opinions on Rex Tillerson.
Looking forward to it.
Next. Justin.